Welcome to episode 4 of season 4 of the Fat Doctor podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Asha Lamy, fat doctor, trans, queer, and fed up. There you go, that's me in a nutshell. Although I'm quite excited about today, we're going to be talking about perimenopause. This is a topic of conversation when I spoke to my online membership group, The Waiting Room, and I said to everyone, what would you like me to talk about? This is the one that everyone went, please talk about perimenopause. Literally, I think there was about 5 or 6 different people that said this. And those in the group will know that I have already spoken in detail about perimenopause. We did an entire we have a monthly checkup. Every month we check in with each other and we talked about it quite a lot this month. So I might be repeating myself. If you're one of those people who was there on the day, but if not, then hopefully you'll get a kick out of this. If it doesn't apply to you and you think, why would I want to waste my time listening to a podcast episode about perimenopause? Either don't, just skip this one, or listen and learn, because there's so much to be said here that goes beyond just the symptoms and, you know, the treatment and stuff, that sort of really digs down into the intersection between medical misogyny and medical weight stigma. So let's get into it. I'm going to start with some, I guess, facts and information, just because I think we have to start at the beginning, don't we? And we have to understand exactly what perimenopause is. And for those who don't know, it's a term that refers to the years, transitional phase, the years leading up to the menopause. The menopause is when fertility ends, periods stop. And once you hadn't had a period for over a year, then you're considered postmenopausal. And it doesn't just happen out of the blue, randomly one day. Your periods don't just go, oh, we're done now. Generally, what tends to happen is you have this kind of transitional phase. It can last up years, and it depends. It varies from person to person. But there are a few classical features, symptoms, whatever you want to call them, that most of us, and I include myself there, who have been or are going through the process, can relate to. So what happens is we stop making estrogen. Since we started menstruating, we've been making estrogen for the most part, and we stop making estrogen, we stop making progesterone, or we stop making as much of it, I should say, and that will impact our body in a number of different ways. There are so many different symptoms of perimenopause, and one of the things is that they are quite insidious. We don't realize it's happening for a really long time, because things like fatigue and joint pains and headaches and lightheadedness, I mean, these could be caused by so many different things. And often we don't think hormones first and foremost. That kind of comes after we've done all the tests and investigations and seen all the specialists, and no one can figure out what's wrong. And then eventually they're like, oh yeah, it could be your hormones. If you're watching the video, you can see me making my face right now. Hormones should be near the top of the list. It's bloody obvious, isn't it? But it often isn't. And once again, here is where medical misogyny comes into it. Obviously, you don't have to be a woman to have periods and therefore go through the menopause. You're looking at someone who is not a woman and is perimenopausal. But misogyny doesn't just impact women. It impacts us on many levels, and one of those is that if you have a uterus, then you'll definitely be impacted by medical misogyny. And by that I mean that doctors are far less invested, and I should say the healthcare system as a whole is far less invested in anything that relates to uteruses, vaginas, cervixes, hormones, especially estrogen and progesterone. Not really invested. Actually, they're not really invested in anyone that has a uterus. That's why studies have shown that, and I'm going to use the term women here for want of a better word. You understand that that doesn't necessarily just mean women, but we haven't got any studies to include trans people, so it is just women according to the studies. But women, they are far less likely, well, they are more likely to have their symptoms of a heart attack or heart problems, cardiovascular disease, ignored just because they're women, not for any other reason. That's a bit of a problem, isn't it? And that kind of applies to a lot of things. And there's far less money and time and effort invested into conditions that only impact people with the uterus. And of course, perimenopause is one of them. Also, I mean, I don't know if you've been noticing, but people are starting to talk about how periods really impact us. Like, you know, they're no fun. And those who don't have a uterus and are not menstruating don't understand how it impacts us. And they have expected us to carry on as if nothing's happening, to just go to work and continue to function like it's not a problem. And the same applies to perimenopause. We are literally going through something physiological here, physiological, that will impact our ability to function in society. Things like brain fog, difficulty concentrating, aches and pains, tiredness, all of that stuff. It's going to impact our I'm going to say functioning. Yeah. In the workplace, in the home, in an educational environment, just anywhere. But people don't really care about that because it's not really important, is it? Probably not. Anyway, I digress. Where were we? Perimenopause. We defined it and I explained that it was about hormones, and then I started being a bit ranty because I will get ranty today. You know, it's obvious that I will. But when it comes to the symptoms, we can, and I often do, separate them into three different sort of subgroups. I find it helpful to do this, and a lot of clinicians will do this. So you've got your physical symptoms, your psychological symptoms, and then what we call the vasomotor symptoms. And the vasomotor symptoms are the ones like hot flashes and night sweats, which are absolutely horrendous and debilitating in so many different ways. And these are the vasomotor symptoms. You don't have to have vasomotor symptoms to be perimenopausal. But you do, you know, generally tend to be perimenopausal if you're getting vasomotor symptoms. If you're getting vasomotor symptoms like night sweats and hot flashes, but you're not perimenopausal, in other words, you either don't have a uterus or you're postmenopausal, or you're nowhere near the menopause, then you need to go to a doctor. You shouldn't be getting night sweats. That's not normal. But if you are perimenopausal, it becomes part of life, which is great. What is pathological in men or people without a uterus, what is pathological in young people, is considered normal. And, you know, just get on with it if you are between the ages of 40 and 55. And that's roughly when we're expecting the perimenopause. It could be earlier, it could be later. There's lots of reasons why people can go into early menopause. But for the most part, it tends to be sort of early to mid 40s, up to a decade before you turn 50. 50 is the average age to go through menopause, but it can be later, it can be earlier. Beyond 55, if you're still menstruating, you probably need to go and see a doctor as well, just to make sure everything's okay. It's probably fine, but just to be sure. But you're in somewhere in that area is when you'll start to experience symptoms. And as I said, they can be debilitating. So those are the vasomotor ones. But actually, the psychological ones are the ones we don't tend to notice. So things like low mood, irritability, anxiety, panic attacks, brain fog, just difficulty concentrating. And sometimes it can be genuinely cognitive, you know, you like forget words, you're struggling to remember what you're doing. It can be quite awful, really. And you don't realize what's going on, and it comes and goes because it's fluctuating. Remember, I said it was fluctuating hormones. So it comes and goes, which makes it even worse. But for the most part, fatigue is, you know, par for the course, I would argue. Then you've got your physical symptoms, like numbness and tingling is common, as is joint pains, muscle pains, headaches, lightheadedness. They're all sorts. And if you're really interested in all the different ones and you'd like to know whether or not you personally have any of these perimenopausal symptoms, then the Green Climacteric Scale, green is spelt like the colour but with an E on the end, is a really good like questionnaire, and you can find it on the website if you just Google it. And you you know, just asked about the symptoms, but you're asked about the severity of the symptoms, and you get a score, and the scoring is quite helpful. You know, it's not perfect, but it's a pretty crude but useful way of saying. And a lot of people will read and go, "Oh, I didn't know that was a symptom of perimenopause. Oh, I've got that as well. Oh, I've got that. Yeah, it's really bad. Oh, now don't forget, if you have a condition that causes some of these symptoms, that doesn't mean that you can rule perimenopause out. Oh, well, I've got chronic fatigue syndrome, so of course I'm fatigued. Or, oh, yes, well, I have fibromyalgia, so of course I've got joint pain. Yeah, sure, of course. And maybe you've had that for a really long time. Maybe you were diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia, and nobody considered your hormones. That's not great. Probably ought to see someone about that. Or maybe you were diagnosed in your 20s, 30s, it had nothing to do with your hormones, but your hormones are making it worse. Also, go see someone about that. The problem is, as of course you know, is that not only is there medical misogyny and medical weight stigma, but there's also medical ableism or discrimination against the disabled. So you've got all those three things to contend with. Lovely. Ugh. How delightful for you. And of course, no one cares. Why would anyone care? I care, but I'm just one person. I'm sure other people care too. There are some fantastic OBGYNs that I follow on Instagram. Dr. Heather Irabond is one of the people that I adore and is a good friend, and I can't praise her enough. But there are some others as well. Heather has experience of being a woman and a fat woman and a fat black woman at that. So really wonderful. And I'm not saying that everyone's horrible, but a lot of doctors aren't great. That's the truth, isn't it? So we know what perimenopause is. We know what causes it, fluctuation in hormone levels. We know that it causes various symptoms and they're often ignored. Let's talk about treatment. Now, there are lots of, you know, as you've probably heard me talk about before, informed consent is all about talking about benefits, risks, alternative options. And I want to do that today, but this is not meant to be like a replacement for seeing your own doctor, right? This is a podcast. I'm not your doctor. So listen up, listen to what I have to say. Hopefully you'll get something out of it, but like, don't be like, oh, well, okay, well, Asha said, so that's not how it works. I'm not your doctor. And everybody individual is different. So this is all about kind of giving some information out. There are some useful websites. Unfortunately, I have not found a decent website that doesn't include massively stigmatizing and massively transphobic language, because every website I find talks about women, which is not helpful. As I said, I'm going through perimenopause and I'm not a woman, and it's really fucking frustrating not being able to find in 2023 useful information that uses neutral language. Really fucking frustrating, British Menopause Society. I mean, come on, get a grip. But also, you know, you'll go on there and there's loads of really useful stuff, and then of course next to it is all this crap stuff about weight loss and nutrition and all this bullshit. So it, you know, yes, they exist out there, lots of useful information, but also sorry, I don't know what that was. That was me growling, I think. I did a little kind of, you can't, if you're watching the video, you can see like I did a claw thing, but if you're just listening, yeah, never mind. Okay, so let's talk HRT, because HRT is something that certainly when I was when I first qualified and when I was training, is something that we almost as doctors were discouraging patients from taking. I remember being sort of like almost gatekeeping it, like, oh, are you sure you want HRT? You probably don't want HRT. Here's the reasons why you shouldn't take HRT. Could you consider something else? And that's because HRT got a really bad rap for a very long time, partly because of really crap evidence that people were basing their decisions on, and again partly because of misogyny. Why should people take HRT? Oh, for goodness sake, it's just the menopause, get over yourself. That was the attitude. And then certainly in the UK, and I don't know if this has been the case elsewhere, I've only practiced here, but I can't remember exactly when it was. Maybe it's almost 10 years ago. Maybe it's more recent, when new guidelines were introduced that were like, hey, doctors, menopause actually sucks. Perimenopause sucks. Can you stop denying people treatment? Give them the facts and let them decide. So here are the facts as we know it about HRT. First, let me explain very simply what HRT is. It is simply, it's hormone replacement therapy. And as it stands, I'm talking about hormone replacement therapy for menopause, not for transgender affirming care, like completely separate. Although some things will be the same and you'll recognise. So hormone replacement therapy, as I said, you've got fluctuating levels of estrogen and progesterone, and we're simply supplementing them with estrogen and progesterone. That's helpful. If you have a uterus, then you can't just take estrogen on its own, even though estrogen is the one that's going to make you feel significantly better. It's the one that's going to give you the energy and it's going to help with a lot of those symptoms. You can't just take estrogen if you've got a uterus, because you put your significant risk of endometrial cancer. Now, if you've had your uterus removed, you're fine. You can just take estrogen. But if you haven't had your uterus removed, if you still have a uterus, you're going to need some progesterone as well. And progesterone can be given orally in the form of a tablet. It can be given transdermally, in other words, in a patch, and it can be given locally through a progesterone releasing intrauterine device or intrauterine system, and the Myrina coil is the common one, but any coil that secretes progesterone, that's going to act locally on the womb. It's going to prevent endometrial cancer, and that can be your form of progesterone. So either a tablet, a patch, or the coil, the Myrina coil. With estrogen, pretty similar. You can give it in the form of a tablet. You can give it topically, and that's either with a patch or with gel. Or you can give it locally with estrogen cream, and that really is to treat symptoms of vaginal dryness, soreness, and discomfort, which is one of the many joys of going through the perimenopause. The nice thing about locally acting estrogen is you don't need progesterone, because that's safe, but obviously it only works locally. So if that's your only symptom, that's the one to go for. Otherwise, if you've got more kind of like sort of generalized systemic symptoms, then that's not going to work. So that's HRT in a nutshell. You can take it daily or continuously, or you can take it cyclically or sequentially. In other words, you take some estrogen and then some progesterone to kind of mimic the menstrual cycle. Generally, if you're perimenopausal and you're still getting periods, we would recommend cyclical. And if you're postmenopausal, we would recommend continuous, but you can do both. It's just that when you're doing it cyclically, you're almost certainly going to get a withdrawal bleed. People who don't want periods won't necessarily like that, especially if their periods have stopped and then they start again. All right, that's the information part. Let's talk risks, right? Because benefits are obvious. Your hormones are replaced so you feel better, and it treats all of your symptoms. It treats the psychological and the physical and the vasomotor symptoms all in one go. It can be massively life-changing. And for some people, it's like, meh, didn't really help. You don't know until you try it. I can't possibly predict which one it's going to be. Some people, most people, to be fair, I prescribe a lot of HRT. And generally, when I prescribe it, people would come back and be like, oh my gosh, my life is so different. Some would come back and go, I feel much better, but not great. And I'd be like, okay, let's up the dose and see how you go. And then they'll come back and go, oh, that's amazing. And some people just never really responded that well to it. And so we tried other things. And that's the way medicine works, folks. We don't have any answers. We just have suggestions. And you just got to take it as it comes. So those are the benefits. The risks are the most important risk that people will be aware of is the risk of breast cancer. And this generally comes from the progesterone component, because people who are on estrogen only HRT are not really significantly at an increased risk of breast cancer. But if you are taking progesterone as well, then the risks are something along the lines of, and first of all, you have to understand that this is from observational studies only, so not massively helpful, and there's limitations to the evidence, but it's the best evidence we have. So when it comes to breast cancers, there are an additional, so this is not like this is how many people are going to get breast cancer. This is, of all the breast cancers out there, we see an additional number of breast cancer, additional 1 in 70 breast cancers are seen in people who are on cyclical HRT, and it's about 1 in 50 additional breast cancer cases for people who are on continuous HRT. 1 in 70, 1 in 50. But that's not say you have a 1 in 70 chance. That's to say, of all the people that got diagnosed with breast cancer, there's a 1 in 70 additional chance if you are on HRT. So the risk is relatively low. And if you have a history of breast cancer, you're not going to be offered HRT. Well, pretty sure you won't be. It's pretty risky. And maverick of any doctor to offer HRT to somebody who has a history of breast cancer. And of course, if you have a very strong family history, and by strong family history, I mean at least two first degree or relatives that have had breast cancer, I probably wouldn't recommend it either. If you have only one relative, first degree relative that's died of breast cancer or has had breast cancer, folks, that doesn't put you at a particularly increased risk. That's just bad luck. It has to be at least two. But again, these aren't decisions you should make lightly, and these are decisions that you should be having and taking and discussing with your own doctors, not with me. This is a podcast. It's not even a medical podcast. It's a ranty podcast. But that's the information. There's also an increased risk of deep vein thrombosis, so a blood clot in the deep veins of the lungs, or pulmonary embolism, which is a blood clot in the lungs. Again, if you don't have a history of this personally or a very strong family history of this, it's unlikely to affect you. The risk is very low, but it's there. Those are the main risks. And then there are lots of alternative options. There's a new drug, and I forgot the name. It's a funny name. It begins with a V. Vazua or something. I don't know. I'll put it in the show notes. But there's a new drug that's out. And when I say new, I mean it hasn't really been around for that long. I think it was licensed very recently in the UK. Probably was licensed earlier in the US. But it's supposed to be a game changer, which is great, because we don't have enough medications out there. But it works for vasomotor symptoms only. So it's just for the hot flashes and it's, you know, the night sweats and stuff like that. It doesn't work on any of the other symptoms. There are a couple of other medications that, well, there's another one called clonidine, which has been around for a long time. To be honest, with that particular medication, most people find the side effects outweigh any benefits and don't take it. So this new medication is kind of, you know, probably a better option. I mean, I don't know. You'd again, discuss it with your own doctor. Then, you've got drugs that you can take, medications you can take for like the pins and needles and the joint pain, something like gabapentin. You've got selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs, which are a form of, well, usually used to treat depression and anxiety. They've been shown to be helpful with perimenopausal symptoms, especially, unsurprisingly, the psychological ones, but possibly even with the physical ones as well. And then there's like loads of alternative therapies, complementary therapies. Like there's so much, like acupuncture and various homeopathic remedies and stuff. I'm a big believer in all of these things. Even if there isn't any evidence for them, that's because no one's doing the research, not because they don't work. So I'm all for trying anything. But again, be careful. Like, you know, make sure you're the person that you're taking advice from is someone that you can trust. But don't just rely on Western medicine. That's what I always say. Think about everything. And that's my course. I didn't mean to get all technical about it, but I just don't think this information is out there. I think there's loads of people that just like, I don't even know what menopause is, let alone what to do about it, which is sucks. But now let's talk about weight stigma and how weight stigma impacts menopause and perimenopause. Weight gain is very common during perimenopause. It's natural. I would say it's almost to be expected. Some people will gain more weight than others. Why does it happen? We're not entirely sure. We do know that hormones most likely play a role. And also metabolic changes. Like we do change. Our bodies change over our lifetimes. As you get much older, you tend to lose weight. But during menopause, you tend to gain weight, kind of like you tend to gain weight during pregnancy. Kind of like you tend to gain weight during puberty. It's a hormonal thing, almost certainly, amongst other things, and it's complicated, and actually the body's just doing what the body's meant to do. And like, why are we getting so worked up about it, people? Why? If diet culture didn't exist, if we didn't want to be thin, we wouldn't care, right? If we were not obsessed with being thin, then we'd all be like, yeah, this happens to everyone. Like, you know, our parents and our aunts and uncles and everybody around us would be like, yeah, it's normal. That's what happens. You go through perimenopause, you gain weight. But we're obsessed with A, not gaining weight, and B, losing weight. And so it just can't happen. It can't happen. And oh my, the thing that really boils my piss, a lot of things boil my piss, right? At this point in time, my piss is forever boiling. Stings on the way out, but that's not the point. The thing that really boils my piss are the, and they're almost always men. They're almost always men, and you know this, right? They're almost always cis men who have set themselves up as, I don't know what they call themselves, like health coaches, fitness coaches, whatever, specifically for people going through menopause. Again, this is where misogyny and weight stigma come hand in hand. As I said, chances are you're going to gain a little bit of weight during perimenopause. This is normal. You will probably find that you gain a bit of weight around your belly, and you will probably find that your jeans don't fit quite like they used to. And this will happen gradually and progressively. And we're told that's not supposed to happen. And of course, I forgot, add a bit of ageism in there as well. It's happening as we get older, and around a time when we're being told we're useless, we are losing our fertility, we're losing our youth, and therefore we're failing in every way that matters when it comes to the male gaze, when it comes to white supremacy and this stupid society that prioritizes youth only amongst people with a uterus, by the way, not in men. People with testicles, the older they get, they supposedly mature like a fine wine, and you know, but in people with a uterus, oh my, the older you get, the more useless you become. You can't get a role in Hollywood, you can't get a, you know, people don't want you to sell their products, they don't want you to be the face of, like, you know, let's face it, as you get older and fatter at the same time, because you're going through perimenopause, that is a time when often you are dealing with a lot of insecurities, a lot of issues, a lot of rejection, a lot of, self-doubt, low self-worth. Because especially, I mean, see, if you've been someone that has been traditionally considered attractive and desirable, it's going to hit you really hard, perimenopause, because you stop being desirable and attractive. For the most part, not everyone. But, you know, you get lines around your eyes, and you get a little bit of a chin, and you can no longer do up your jeans anymore, and you know, people pass you by and they don't notice, and that can suck for a lot of people. That can be really rejecting. And even as a fat person, you know, the last thing you want is to get fatter, right? I mean, nobody, even fat people who really enjoy themselves and love themselves and have good self-esteem, it's kind of hard when we keep getting fatter. So yeah, you're made to feel like crap. And at that point in time, when you're at, and not your most vulnerable, but quite a vulnerable place, along comes a man with muscles and hair. They're very rarely bald. They've always got hair. Even though, let's face it, that's what happens to them as they get older, right? They start to lose their hair. But some of them are either faking it, or they've, you know, genetically lucky and they've got hair. So they've got hair, muscles, a really attractive picture of them on social media, and they're like, hey, ladies, fucking ladies, because they don't give a shit about cis people, about trans people, but hey, ladies, want some help keeping the weight off during menopause? I'm your guy. No, you're not. You're a fucking dick is what you are. You are a dick who is capitalizing on insecurity and on weight stigma and on diet culture. Fuck you. I told you I was going to get ranty today. Fuck you, though, because this is misogyny and weight stigma and ageism and ableism all wrapped into one and then served with a healthy dollop of capitalism. There's an alternative to that. And the alternative is embrace it. It's going to happen. You're going to gain weight for the most part. Not everyone does. Some people don't gain weight in their pregnancy, right? We just remain very thin with this tiny little sort of sockable shaped lump in front of them. That's nice. But a lot of us just got fat during pregnancy. Some of us got fatter than others, but you know, it's part of life, isn't it? So for the most part, you're going to gain a little bit of weight. And so it's life. It's not staying there forever. And maybe it's there for a reason. Like maybe for the last, you know, few hundred thousand years, we as a species have evolved in order to survive. And part of that survival is during this period, we gain weight. Imagine if it was like a good thing. I know, weight gain could never be a good thing. Not in the 21st century. But imagine if it was, just for a moment, just like put all your kind of beliefs to one side and imagine if it was. Imagine if we did nothing about it. We just let it happen. Just let it run its course. Accepted that we just have to buy clothes that are a little bit bigger now, and that's just life, and maybe find a new style that suits us better. Or maybe not. Maybe just wear the clothes we want to wear, no matter what we look like, you know? Fuck society, we can wear whatever we want. So whatever it is that you need to do, maybe just embrace the weight gain rather than trying to control it. Because the thing about trying to control it is just you're just going to make things worse for yourself. When you go on a diet, when you start restricting, when you start forcing yourself to do things that make you unhappy, lots of things are going to happen. Your body is going to panic. I've just heard the alarm going off downstairs. I told him I was recording. That better not last. Anyway, it probably didn't. You probably didn't even keep that up, but that's marriage for you. We've just celebrated 20 years of marriage. We don't take marriage, our wedding anniversary, very seriously because it's just a wedding. But yeah, we just had our 20th. Anyway, the alarm is off. What was I saying? Completely got distracted. This is part of life. As I told you, I press record, see what happens, and sometimes alarms go off. What was I saying? I can't remember what I was saying. Oh, what a disaster. When you go on a diet, when you restrict yourself, your body does a lot of things. One of the things your body's going to do is it's going to change its metabolic rate. Like, your metabolic rate is going to change very quickly, actually. And also, it's going to impact the gonadotropin releasing hormone, which is a hormone that is released in the brain, which controls your estrogen and progesterone levels. So dieting is going to impact your hormone levels. It's also going to put stress on your body. Dieting, as we know, no matter what age you are, can cause fatigue. It can cause malnutrition. It can cause headaches and lightheadedness. It can cause irritability and low mood and anxiety and brain fog. And all of these symptoms are symptoms of perimenopause. So why make things worse? I know that in the first few weeks of joining that bloke's course, his, yeah, let's get you all fit and ready for perimenopause course, right? For the first few weeks, you'll probably feel good. You'll feel good because you'll feel virtuous and you'll think, yes, I'm doing something. You might not even be doing it for weight loss. You might just be doing it for your quote unquote health. You're like, yes. Yes, go me. But it doesn't last because the brain is going to start doing things at the same time. The brain is going to be telling you, feed me, please. Feed me, please. And if you stop listening, the brain's going to be like, can we talk about food? No, seriously, can we talk about food? 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 Can we please talk about food? Let's talk about food. Let's talk about food. And it keeps going and going and going. And all you think about is food and you become preoccupied with food. That is normal. That is the body's response to restrictions. So all of a sudden you're going to get this food noise, this food chatter up there. That's not helpful. So we've already got most of the symptoms of perimenopause, plus the food chatter, plus it's impacting your metabolic rate, plus it's impacting your hormones. Again, tell me, why would you want to lose weight during perimenopause? Why would you want to go on a diet? And it doesn't have to be a diet, any form of restriction, any form of this is what you should eat and this is what you shouldn't eat, this is what you should do and this is what you shouldn't do. Exercise should be structured and it should be done this way, otherwise you're doing it wrong. Food, yeah, you can eat whatever you like, but only if you do this, that and the other. No. All of that is restriction. All of that is dieting. Just because you've packaged it into something else, it's still a diet. And if you think you're doing it for your health, you're not doing it for your health. You're doing it for the opposite of your health. You're doing it for lots of reasons, and that's fine. If that's what you want to do, if you're doing it because you don't want to gain weight, I'm not judging you. It's just as long as you know the truth. And the truth is that when you go through the perimenopause, you're just going to get a bit fatter for the most part. And that's it. That's life. There you go. Nothing you can do to stop that, really. And if you try, you may end up causing more drama than it's worth. Remember that weight loss is unsustainable. Remember that your body is amazing and it actually knows what it's doing. And when you kind of begin to listen to it, and I'm a big fan of intuitive eating and intuitive movement, for want of a better word. Like, I love to move myself in a way that makes me happy, and that is completely the opposite of what the world tells me I should be doing. So, like, pretty much now I'm like, what would, and I don't have a name for him. We need to have a name. What would Fitzbo do? What would Jim Bro do? I think, what would Jim Bro do? And then we'll have to give him a name at some point, Tim. What would Jim Bro do? I'll do the opposite. Because whatever Jim Bro is suggesting is probably bad for me. So what would Jim Bro do? What would Fitzpo do? I'll do the opposite. That's my version of intuitive movement. It's not. It's a bit more complicated than that. But when you're eating intuitively, one thing that happens is your body tells you exactly what it needs. And once you get used to listening to your body, it will tell you when you need extra, I don't know, extra iron, extra vitamins, extra this, extra that, extra carbs because you're flagging because your brain's not working very well. Mood, you know, mood and brain fog and all of that stuff. You probably need some carbs, but if you're listening to your body, it will tell you on a daily basis, eat more, eat less, eat this, don't eat that. And that's wonderful. That's an alternative option to weight loss and weight normative care. Listen, if you really want to know more about this, or if you have questions and you want to discuss it, then I have a masterclass coming up. It's this Sunday, the 4th of February. Don't worry if you're listening late and you've missed it. You can always go back and buy the recording, but you can come to the live event or you can just watch the recording. You also get a PDF alongside it. And I love doing these masterclasses. I always find them really, really useful. The more people that show up on the live event, the better. And then we do lots of Q&A and there's always a lot of really helpful discussion. So yeah, that's on the 4th. You can find information about it at www.fatdoctor.co.uk. And as always, you could join my membership group on Discord. Like I said, we've already had this conversation. So if that's something that you want to, you know, to do so that you can be part of the next conversation, and be part of a very small group where you have access to me and my advice, and more importantly, access to other members of the community who are brilliant, by the way, and are giving out such amazing advice to each other. And I'm learning so much, if I'm honest. Then join us, the waiting room. You can find out on the website. Don't forget, there's lots of freebies on there, lots of free resources. Make the most of it. And as always, if you've got a question that you want me to answer, then message me. Talk to me, email me, go through my website and contact me. Tell me what you want to hear about and we'll do that. Join me next time. Take care.